A snapping reputation doesn't roar. It merely coughs politely. It rustles through 200 silk skirts, turning away simultaneously. When Adrian, Duke of Ashbourne, stood amidst a crowded royal gallery and called Beatrix a woman of transactional affections, she refused to faint. She withheld her tears. She just stood frozen, tasting old metallic copper on her tongue, feeling her whalebone corset slowly bruising her ribs with every shallow, panicked breath. Soon after, she went out and bought his entire life. Then she went out and bought him. The Queen's summer gallery smelled overwhelmingly of hot beeswax and sour breath. It was a suffocating combination. 200 bodies draped in heavy velvet and tightly corseted silk, pressed together under a glass ceiling that trapped the July heat. Beatrix stood near the potted palms, holding a glass of tepid champagne. The crystal was slick with condensation. She was 24, considered passably handsome, and burdened with an inheritance that made her a target for every titled bankrupt in London. She knew the game. She had played it with a detached, mild amusement. Until Adrian Pendleton, the Duke of Ashbourne. He was standing 10 feet away, holding court near the fireplace. He didn't look like a hero from a penny dreadful. He was tall, yes, but his shoulders slouched with an exhausted arrogance. His cravat was slightly crooked. He smelled of clove smoke and expensive French brandy. For 3 months, he had courted Beatrix. They had walked in Hyde Park. They had stood too close in dimly lit conservatories. He had touched the bare skin of her wrist, running his thumb over her pulse point, and told her she grounded him. She had believed him. She had actually, stupidly, believed him. Then came the rumor. A forged letter, a whispered accusation in the gentlemen's clubs that Beatrix had entertained a cavalry officer in her carriage. It was crude. It was demonstrably false. Beatrix watched Adrian drain his glass. He handed it to a passing footman without looking at the man. A lesser peer, Lord Harrington, laughed too loudly at something Adrian said, then leaned in. "I see Lady Beatrix is holding her ground, Ashbourne. One must admire the sheer brass of it. Are the wedding invitations still at the printer's?" The gallery went terribly, unnaturally quiet. The orchestra in the corner was playing a waltz, but the notes seemed to drag through molasses. Everyone was listening. Adrian turned his head. His eyes met Beatrix's. They were a flat, pale gray. There was no warmth in them, no shared history, just a terrible defensive pride. He was a man cornered by society's expectations, and rather than defend her, he chose to cut her loose to save his own immaculate standing. "Wedding invitations?" Adrian's voice carried over the waltz. It was dry, bored. "My dear Harrington, one does not print invitations for a woman of such transactional affections. I have a dukedom to maintain, not a charity for straying debutantes." The words hung in the humid air. Beatrix forgot how to breathe. Her lungs seized. The champagne glass in her hand felt impossibly heavy. She waited for the righteous anger, the fiery indignation she had read about in novels. It didn't come. Instead, a wave of profound nausea rolled through her stomach. Her palms began to sweat, making her silk gloves feel slimy against her skin. She looked at him. She wanted to scream. She wanted to throw the champagne in his face, but her throat was locked. Her jaw trembled so violently she had to bite the inside of her cheek to keep her teeth from chattering. She tasted blood. "Walk," her brain commanded. "Just walk." She turned. Her foot caught the edge of the heavy Persian rug. She stumbled, her shoulder bumping hard into a footman holding a tray of oysters. The tray tipped. Ice and gray shells clattered onto the polished parquet floor. A woman nearby giggled. Someone else gasped in faux horror. Beatrix didn't apologize. She didn't look back. She kept her eyes on the heavy oak doors at the end of the hall. She walked with a stiff, unnatural gait, her face burning, her eyes stinging with unshed, humiliating tears. The corset dug savagely into her hips with every step. She reached the carriage. She hauled herself inside, collapsed onto the leather bench, and finally, violently, threw up her breakfast into the brass spittoon. The morning after a social death does not look different from any other morning. The sun still bleeds through the gaps in the heavy velvet curtains. The grandfather clock in the hallway still ticks with rhythmic indifference. Beatrix sat in her father's old study. The room smelled of old paper, leather bindings, and the lingering dusty scent of pipe tobacco. It had been her sanctuary since her father passed, leaving her solely in control of a massive, unglamorous fortune built on northern textile mills. She stared at her breakfast tray. The toast was cold. The butter congealed into a hard, yellow lump. Beside the tray sat the morning papers, the Chronicle, the Post, the Tatler. She didn't need to read them. She had already received three notes from supposed friends, offering their deepest sympathies while simultaneously informing her they could not receive her for tea next week. She was a ghost. At 24, her life in London society was officially over. She pressed her palms against her eyes. They were swollen and gritty from a sleepless night of dry heaving and pacing. She felt hideous. She felt raw. She hated Adrian with a pure, white-hot intensity, but the terrible, pathetic truth was that she still remembered the rough texture of his wool coat against her cheek. She hated herself more for remembering it. The heavy mahogany door creaked open. Mr. Finch, her solicitor, stepped in. He was a small, practical man who smelled of peppermints and anxiety. He carried a thick leather portfolio. "Lady Beatrix," he said, clearing his throat. He did not meet her eyes. The gossip had already reached the law offices of Chancery Lane. "I received your summons, though I must say the hour is quite early." "Sit down, Mr. Finch," Beatrix said. Her voice sounded strange to her own ears. Hoarse. Flat. Finch sat, placing the portfolio on his lap like a shield. "I want you to look into the Duke of Ashbourne," she said. Finch blinked. He pulled a peppermint from his waistcoat pocket, unwrapped it with agonizing slowness, and popped it into his mouth. The sharp smell of mint hit the stagnant air. "My lady, given the events of yesterday evening, would it not be best to put distance between yourself and His Grace? A trip to the continent, perhaps? Italy is lovely in the autumn."
"I'm not running to Italy, Mr. Finch. I want to know about his money."
"Washbourne is one of the oldest titles in the realm. His estates are vast."
"Vast estates require vast upkeep," Beatrix countered, leaning forward. She traced the grain of the mahogany desk with a fingernail.
"He complained to me once about a leaking roof at his country seat that he hadn't fixed. He mentioned offhand that his investments in the Argentine railways were troublesome. Men with immense secure wealth do not complain about leaking roofs. Find out who holds his paper."
Finch hesitated, then opened his portfolio.
"It is an open secret in the city, my lady. The Duke is land rich and cash starved. He maintains the lifestyle of an emperor on the budget of a desperate gambler. He owes the Bank of England. He owes private syndicates. I've heard whispers he even owes the quiet, dangerous men who operate out of the taverns in Cheapside."
Beatrix stopped tracing the desk. She looked up. A very quiet, very cold sensation began to bloom in the center of her chest. It wasn't triumph. It was arithmetic.
"How much?" she asked.
Finch adjusted his spectacles. "Altogether? Mortgages, promissory notes, gambling markers? Easily 200,000 pounds. Perhaps more."
It was a staggering sum. It was enough to buy a small country. It was also, precisely, the liquid capital sitting in Beatrix's accounts, generated by three generations of coffee mill workers and relentless northern industry.
"I want it," Beatrix said.
"Want what, my lady?"
"The debt, all of it." Finch dropped his pen. It left a black splatter of ink across his pristine white cuff. "Lady Beatrix, that is madness. Purchasing toxic debt is a fool's errand. The yield is terrible. The risk of default is almost certain. You would be trading secure government bonds for a bankrupt duke's IOUs."
"I don't care about the yield," Beatrix said. She stood up. Her legs felt steady for the first time in 12 hours. She walked to the window and looked out at the damp, gray London street.
"He stood in front of 200 people and calculated that my ruin was an acceptable price to pay for his comfort. I am going to calculate the exact price of his."
"My lady, you cannot..."
"Buy it, Mr. Finch."
She turned back to him. Her face was pale,
devoid of makeup, her hair pulled back harshly. She looked ruthless. Start with the quiet, dangerous men in Cheapside. Pay a premium if you must. Then go to the syndicates, then the banks. I want the mortgage to his ancestral home. I want the markers for his horses. I want the promissory notes for the very boots on his feet. By the end of the month, I don't want Adrian Pendleton to be able to buy a pint of ale without my written permission. Buying a man's ruin is not a glamorous process. It does not happen in polished drawing rooms. It happens in the grimy, smoke-choked arteries of the City of London, a place Beatrix had never been permitted to go. Over the next 3 weeks, she became intimately acquainted with the smell of desperation. She wore a heavy dark veil and a plain wool traveling dress that scratched at her collarbone. Accompanied by the sweating, miserable Mr. Finch, she descended into cramped offices above apothecaries, where the air smelled of boiling cabbage and wet rot. Their first acquisition was a man named Sullivan. He operated out of a back room near the docks. The floorboards were sticky. Sullivan was missing two front teeth and smelled heavily of gin and raw onions. He held £10,000 of Adrian's gambling debts. "The Duke ain't paid the interest in 6 months," Sullivan rasped, tapping a dirty fingernail against a ledger. "Why do you want this paper, lady? It's bleeding useless unless you got the muscle to break a duke's legs. And nobody breaks a duke's legs." "I am offering you 80 pence on the pound for it," Beatrix said. Her voice was muffled through the veil. She kept her hands tightly clasped in her lap. The chair she sat on felt greasy. "Cash. Today. You rid yourself of a dead asset, and I take the risk." Sullivan's eyes narrowed, shifting from Beatrix to Finch's bulging leather satchel. "Done. The exchange was made." Beatrix watched Finch count out the thick stacks of banknotes. Her inheritance, her security, slid across a sticky table for a few scraps of heavy parchment covered in Adrian's elegant, sweeping handwriting. She reached out and touched the promissory notes. The paper was rough. The ink was a dark iron gall, faded slightly at the edges. "I, Adrian Pendleton, Duke of Ashbourne, do promise to pay." Her stomach gave a strange, complicated lurch. It was a terrifying feeling. She was actively setting fire to her own fortress to ensure the smoke choked the man who built his castle next door. The syndicates were next. They required more finesse. They sat in wood-paneled rooms in Lombard Street, men in sharp suits who offered Beatrix sherry and tried to patronize her.
"My dear Lady Beatrix," a banker named Caldwell purred, offering her a silver tray of biscuits. "Purchasing the mortgage on the Ashbourne country estate is highly irregular. The estate is entailed. Even if he defaults, forcing a sale is a legal nightmare."
"I have excellent solicitors," Beatrix said dryly, ignoring the biscuits. The sherry smelled like vinegar. "And I am willing to pay above market value for the mortgage. You want liquidity, Mr. Caldwell. I am offering it." Day by day, the leather portfolio Mr. Finch carried grew heavier. Beatrix traded the deeds to three of her father's most profitable mills for the debts on Adrian's London townhouse. She sold her mother's parure of Indian diamonds, stones she had planned to wear on her wedding day, to acquire the loans backing Adrian's failed shipping ventures. The process was exhausting. She slept poorly, waking up in cold sweats, panicked by what she was doing. She was a woman alone, stripping herself of hard assets for the sake of a vendetta. There were moments in the dead of night where she lay staring at the ceiling, crying silently, mourning the safe, predictable life she had murdered in the span of 3 weeks. She missed the ignorant girl she had been a month ago, but then she would remember the polite coughs in the Royal Gallery, the ice and oyster shells hitting the floor, the flat, bored tone in Adrian's voice when he called her transactional, and the panic would recede, replaced by a cold, anchoring iron. On a rainy Tuesday, the final acquisition was complete. Beatrix sat in Finch's office. The gas lamps hissed softly against the gloom of the afternoon. Rain lashed against the window panes. Finch placed a thick, heavy stack of documents on the desk. They were bound in red ribbon. "That's all of it," Finch said. He sounded exhausted. He looked 10 years older. "Every mortgage, every loan, every marker, £194,000. You have liquidated nearly 60% of your father's estate.
Beatrix stared at the stack. She didn't reach for it right away. She listened to the rain. She felt a phantom pinch of the whalebone corset from that day at court. Slowly she reached out. She untied the red ribbon. The velvet ribbon slid through her fingers, soft and yielding. She fanned the papers out across the desk, a patchwork quilt of a man's ruin.
She picked up the top note. It was the deed to Ashbourne House, his London residence. She closed her eyes and brought the paper close to her face. It didn't smell like clove smoke or French brandy. It smelled like dust and dried ink.
"Thank you, Mr. Finch," Beatrix whispered.
"What now, my lady?" Finch asked, his voice hushed. "Do we send a letter demanding payment?"
Beatrix opened her eyes. The tears were gone. The nausea was gone. All that remained was a stark, unyielding clarity.
"No," Beatrix said, carefully stacking the papers back together. "We don't send a letter. We wait for the season to begin. We wait for him to throw his annual masquerade ball. And then, Mr. Finch, we do not send a letter. We send the bailiffs."
The invitation to the Duke of Ashbourne's autumn masquerade arrived on heavy cream-colored cardstock, its edges gilded in real gold. Beatrix had not been invited, of course. The card belonged to Mr. Finch's nephew, a minor clerk who owed Finch a favor and possessed a waistline similar to Beatrix's. She stood in front of her standing mirror. The costume was a plague doctor. It was decidedly unglamorous. Heavy black wool draped from her shoulders to the floor, smelling faintly of mothballs and damp basement air. The leather beak of the mask pressed uncomfortably against the bridge of her nose, trapping her own hot breath against her cheeks. She wore no corset. She needed to be able to breathe. She needed to be able to stand perfectly still without fainting. The carriage ride to Grosvenor Square was a masterclass in nausea. Every jolt of the cobblestone sent a fresh wave of sour panic up her throat. She gripped the leather window strap until her knuckles ached, staring blankly at the gas lamp smearing past in the November fog. "I could turn back," she thought. "I could send Finch tomorrow with a polite, legally binding letter."
But she remembered the oyster shells. She remembered the collective, eager intake of breath from the Royal Gallery when Adrian had discarded her. A letter would not suffice. A letter was private. Ruin, as Adrian had taught her, only mattered if it had an audience. Ashbourne House was ablaze with light. The air inside the grand foyer was thick with the suffocating scent of hothouse lilies and melting beeswax. 500 people crushed together, a shifting sea of silks, velvets, feathers, and forced laughter. The orchestra in the grand ballroom was playing a frantic, breathless polka.
Beatrix slipped through the archway, a black smear against a backdrop of peacock blues and glittering golds. No one looked twice at her. She was anonymous. She was exactly what she had been for the last 3 months, a ghost. She found a spot near a massive marble pillar, her back pressed against the cold stone, and waited.
Adrian was easy to spot. He was holding court near the sweeping double staircase. He wore a simple black domino mask, trusting his height, his broad shoulders, and his impeccable evening coat to announce his identity. He looked relaxed. He held a glass of dark amber liquid, laughing easily at a joke told by Lord Harrington, who was dressed as a remarkably unconvincing Roman emperor.
Beatrix watched Adrian's throat work as he swallowed his drink. She felt a phantom pressure on her waist, the memory of his hand guiding her through a waltz. Her stomach cramped violently. She hated him. But the body is a stupid, traitorous thing, and it remembered the ghost of his touch with a pathetic, lingering ache. She forced herself to focus on the heavy bundle of legal parchment tucked into the deep, hidden pocket of her cloak.
At exactly midnight, the grandfather clock in the hall began to chime. Before the third strike, the heavy oak doors of the foyer did not open with a grand flourish. They were pushed open, rather rudely, by a man in a damp gray Macintosh. He was followed by four others. They did not wear masks. They wore bowler hats, which they did not remove. They smelled of wet wool, cheap tobacco, and the bleak, uncompromising reality of the London magistrate's court. The footman at the door stepped forward, his powdered wig bobbing. "Here now, you cannot enter. This is a private..." The lead man, A bailiff named Mr. Croup simply shoved a piece of paper into the footman's chest and kept walking. His heavy, mud-caked boots left dull brown smears on the pristine black-and-white marble tiles. The frantic polka staggered and died as the musicians noticed the intrusion. The laughter snapped off. The silence that rolled through the ballroom was absolute, thick, and suffocating. It was the exact same silence Beatrix had endured in the summer gallery. Adrian stepped forward, descending two steps of the grand staircase. His jaw was tight. The relaxed arrogance had vanished, replaced by the rigid, defensive posture of a man who suddenly realized he was surrounded.
"What is the meaning of this?" Adrian's voice echoed off the gilded ceiling. It was hard, commanding. "Who let these men in?"
Mr. Croup stopped at the base of the stairs. He did not look intimidated. Men who repossess the beds of dying debtors rarely care about a duke's tone of voice. He pulled a thick sheaf of documents from his coat. "Adrian Pendleton, Duke of Ashbourne?" Croup asked, his voice a flat, nasal drone that cut through the silence like a rusty saw.
"You know exactly who I am. Remove your hat in my house and explain yourself before I have you thrown into the street."
"Not your house anymore, Your Grace," Croup said, stifling a small cough. He licked his thumb and began peeling through the papers. "I've here a writ of possession. Foreclosure on the mortgage of Ashbourne House, Grosvenor Square. I also have a writ of attachment for all chattels, furnishings, art, and conveyances within the property. Outstanding debts totaling £194,000. You are in default, Your Grace." The crowd inhaled. It was a vicious, beautiful sound. 500 people suddenly smelling blood in the water.
Adrian's face, beneath the black silk mask, went the color of old ash. For a second, just a fraction of a second, the mask of the untouchable Duke shattered. His eyes widened, his mouth opened slightly, and he looked entirely, pathetically lost. He looked like a frightened boy.
"That is a lie," Adrian snapped, but his voice cracked on the final word. "My solicitors handle my accounts. I have arrangements with the syndicates. The Bank of England..." "The syndicates sold your paper, Your Grace," Croup interrupted, profoundly bored. "So did the bank. So did Sullivan down at the docks. It's all been consolidated, bought up, every single penny."
"By whom?" Adrian demanded, descending the final steps, towering over the bailiff. "Who bought it? Name the man."
Beatrix pushed off the marble pillar. Her legs felt like lead. Her heart was beating so hard it rattled against her ribcage, a frantic, bruising rhythm. She reached up with trembling fingers and unbuckled the leather straps of the plague mask. She pulled it off, taking her black wool hood with it. Her hair, pinned up carelessly, fell slightly loose around her pale face. She stepped out of the shadows and onto the edge of the smeared mud tracks left by the bailiffs. The crowd parted for her instinctively. She walked slowly, feeling the heavy gaze of 500 people burning into her skin. She didn't look at them. She kept her eyes locked on Adrian. He saw her. He stopped moving. The anger bled out of his posture, leaving only a hollow, stunned paralysis. He stared at her as if she had clawed her way out of a grave.
"Not a man, Your Grace," Beatrix said. Her voice wasn't a triumphant roar. It was quiet. It shook slightly at the edges. Her throat was terribly dry, but the acoustics of the silent room carried it to every corner. She stopped 3 feet from him. She reached into her cloak and pulled out the bundle of deeds, tied with the soft red velvet ribbon.
"You mentioned once," Beatrix said, her voice steadying, growing colder as she looked into his panicked gray eyes, "that you had a dukedom to maintain. I decided to see what it cost." She held the bundle out, letting it drop to the muddy floor between them. It hit the marble with a heavy final thud. "You are overdrawn, Adrian. I want my house emptied by morning."
"The aftermath of an earthquake doesn't feel chaotic. It feels dead. The dust settles, the screaming stops, and all that is left is the miserable, back-breaking labor of sifting through the rubble." At 9 o'clock the following morning, the sky over London was a bruised, heavy purple, threatening sleet. Beatrix sat behind her father's massive oak desk in the study. The room was freezing. She hadn't asked the maids to light the fire. She sat wrapped in a thick wool shawl,
a cup of cooling tea at her elbow, staring at the ledger book open in front of her. She felt thoroughly, entirely hollow. There had been no joy in the masquerade. When she had walked out of Ashbourne House, leaving Adrian standing paralyzed over his own ruined deeds, she hadn't felt vindicated. She had climbed into her carriage, pulled the curtain shut, and wept until her chest ached. It was a horrible, ugly crying, mourning the death of her own innocence, mourning the cruel thing she had forced herself to become.
A sharp knock at the heavy front doors echoed through the silent house. Minutes later, the study door opened. Mr. Finch stood there, looking pale and deeply uncomfortable. "He is here, my lady. He insists on seeing you. He bypassed the butler entirely."
Before Finch could step aside, Adrian pushed past him into the room. He did not look like a duke. He looked like a man who had spent the night walking the streets. He was still wearing his evening clothes from the masquerade, though the coat was crumpled, and his white cravat hung loose and unknotted around his neck. His hair was disheveled, damp with fog. He smelled of stale brandy, cold sweat, and sheer, raw panic.
"Leave us, Mr. Finch," Beatrix said quietly. Finch hesitated, glancing at Adrian's aggressive posture, then bowed and shut the door behind him. The heavy silence of the study settled around them. The only sound was the ticking of the mantel clock and the harsh, ragged pull of Adrian's breathing. He stood in the center of the room, glaring at her.
"Is this a joke?" Adrian demanded, his voice thick with exhaustion. "Is this some elaborate, vindictive, theatrical performance you've concocted to embarrass me?"
"I don't have the imagination for theater, Adrian," Beatrix said. She didn't look up at him. She kept her eyes on the ledger. She picked up her pen, dipped it in the inkwell, and carefully made a check mark next to a line item. "Ashbourne House. Secured. You cannot possibly hold my debt."
He stepped closer to the desk, slamming his hands flat against the polished oak. The inkwell rattled.
"You do not have the capital. It's impossible."
"My grandfather owned 20 textile mills in Manchester," Beatrix recited, her tone perfectly flat, as if reading a grocery list. "My father doubled that. They employed thousands of men, women, and children who worked 14-hour days in lung-choking dust. The capital generated from their misery is currently sitting in a vault at the Bank of England. Or rather, it was, until I traded it for the markers you left at Sullivan's gaming tables and the mortgages you took to buy thoroughbreds you couldn't afford."
"Donette."
She finally looked up at him. His eyes were bloodshot. The arrogant sneer was completely gone. He looked cornered.
"Why?" he whispered. The fight seemed to suddenly drain out of his arms, and he sagged against the desk. "Because of a comment at court? Because I didn't defend you against a rumor? You bankrupted yourself to ruin me over a moment of cowardice?"
"You didn't just fail to defend me," Beatrix said. Her throat tightened, the old copper taste returning to her mouth. She swallowed hard, forcing it down.
"You threw me to the wolves to distract them from your own smell. You called me transactional."
She reached out and tapped the ledger with a cold, pale finger.
"So, I made a transaction."
Adrian stared at her. He blinked, the reality of the situation finally, brutally taking root in his mind. He pushed off the desk and began to pace the small area of the Persian rug, running a trembling hand through his damp hair.
"Beatrix, listen to me," he started, his voice dropping into the low, intimate register he had used in the conservatories 3 months ago, the tone that used to make her pulse jump.
"We can fix this. I can secure a loan from the Duke of Westmoreland. He's my godfather. I can pay you back, with interest. You don't want these estates. They are a nightmare to manage. The entailments alone..."
"The entailments have been broken," Beatrix interrupted smoothly.
"Mr. Finch is very thorough. When you defaulted on the primary mortgage, the covenants were breached. The courts granted me full repossession."
Adrian stopped pacing. He stared at her, horrified. You mean to take my home?"
"I mean to take everything," Beatrix corrected. "The townhouse is already being inventoried. The bailiffs are currently tagging the furniture, the paintings, the silver."
"You can't."
His voice broke. It was a raw, pathetic sound.
"Beatrix, please. My mother died in that house. Her portrait is in the drawing room.
Beatrix looked at him. She looked at the man she had fancied herself in love with. He was begging. She had wanted this. She had hallucinated this exact moment during her sleepless nights. But looking at him now, stripped of his power, smelling of fear and stale alcohol, she didn't feel victorious. She felt like a butcher standing over a bleeding animal. It was ugly work.
"I have no interest in your mother's portrait," Beatrix said, her voice weary. "You may take your personal effects, clothes, letters." She opened a drawer in the desk and pulled out a single, stark sheet of paper, sliding it across the wood toward him. "But you will sign this." Adrian looked down at the paper.
"What is it?" "A document acknowledging total insolvency," Beatrix said. "It grants me full power of attorney over the Ashbourne estates. It hands over the management of your tenant farms, your remaining liquid assets, and your trusts. You will no longer have the authority to sign a check, sell a horse, or dismiss a servant without my explicit written consent."
Adrian recoiled as if the paper were hot iron. "I am a peer of the realm. You are asking me to make myself your legal ward. It is castration."
"It is survival," Beatrix countered coldly. "If you do not sign it, I will take the debts to the magistrate tomorrow. I will force a public bankruptcy. You will be sent to Fleet Prison, a duke in debtor's prison. Imagine the society papers."
He stared at her, his chest heaving. The silence stretched until it felt like a physical weight in the freezing room. Slowly, agonizingly, Adrian reached into his waistcoat. He pulled out a heavy gold fountain pen. His hand was shaking so violently he dropped it twice before he could unscrew the cap. He leaned over the desk. He didn't read the document. He just dragged the nib across the bottom line, his signature a jagged, ugly scrawl. He threw the pen on the desk. It clattered against the inkwell.
"Done," he whispered, his voice toxic with hatred. "Are you satisfied, my lady?"
Beatrix looked at the wet ink. She reached out, took the paper, and carefully blotted it. "Not yet," she said. She held out her hand, palm up. "The ring."
Adrian froze. He looked down at his right hand. On his little finger rested the Ashbourne signet ring, heavy gold, set with a blood-red carnelian engraved with the family crest. It had been on his hand since his father died. It was the physical manifestation of his title, used to seal every official document of his life. "No," he breathed, taking a step back. "It's personal. It has no monetary value."
"It has the power to bind the estate in contract," Beatrix said, her hand still extended, unflinching.
"And you no longer have that power. Give it to me."
He looked at her hand. Then he looked at her face. He was searching for a crack, a sliver of the soft, compliant girl he had walked with in Hyde Park. But Beatrix had buried that girl under a mountain of toxic debt. She stared back at him with dead, flat eyes. With a slow, agonizing movement, Adrian reached over and gripped the ring. It was tight on his finger. He had to twist it, the metal scraping harshly against his knuckle. His skin turned white, then red. He pulled it off. He didn't place it in her hand. He dropped it on the desk. It landed with a heavy, dull clink against the wood. Without another word, Adrian turned and walked out of the study. The heavy oak door clicked shut behind him. Beatrix sat alone in the freezing room. She reached out and picked up the signet ring. It was still warm from his skin. The warmth made her stomach turn over. She closed her fist around it, the sharp edges of the carnelian digging painfully into her palm, and she squeezed until her hand went entirely numb. Revenge, Beatrix quickly learned, is not a singular dramatic event. It is a grueling administrative burden. It is paperwork. It is ledgers. It is the endless, suffocating intimacy of managing a life that is not your own.
3 weeks had passed since the masquerade. The scandal had detonated across London society with the force of a powder keg. The gossip sheets printed nothing else. The Duke and the creditor. The fall of the House of Ashbourne. Beatrix had become a pariah of a different sort. No longer the discarded, ruined girl, but a terrifying, unnatural creature. A woman who dealt in the dirty, masculine world of debt. She was shunned, but it was a shunning born of deep,
existential fear rather than contempt. Adrian, meanwhile, had been forced to move into a small, damp gatehouse on the edge of his own sprawling country estate in Kent. Beatrix had claimed the main house, not to live in it, but to strip it. On a freezing Tuesday morning, they stood together at Tattersall's, the premier horse auction in London. The air under the massive glass dome was thick with the smell of wet hay, horse sweat, manure, and the sharp tang of cigar smoke from the gathered gentlemen. The noise was a constant overlapping roar of shouting auctioneers, stamping hooves, and murmured conversations. Beatrix stood near the railing of the main ring. She wore a heavy gray wool coat, its high collar turned up against the draft, and sensible thick-soled boots. Her hands were buried deep in her pockets to hide the fact that her fingers were perpetually cold.
Adrian stood 2 feet to her left. He was no longer the imposing figure of the summer gallery. His coat, while expertly tailored, looked slightly too large for him now. He had lost weight. The arrogant jut of his chin had been replaced by a stiff, brittle tension. He kept his eyes fixed strictly on the sawdust in the center of the ring. He hated being here. He hated being seen with her. Every peer who walked past them offered a wide berth, their eyes sliding sideways to take in the spectacle of the Duke of Ashbourne attending the liquidation of his own prized hunting stables, chaperoned by his female creditor. "Lot 42!" the auctioneer bellowed, his gavel cracking against the wooden podium. "Goliath, 8-year-old gray gelding, exceptional jumper, flawless lineage." A handler led a massive, beautiful gray horse into the ring. The animal tossed its head, its breath pluming in the freezing air, its coat gleaming with a silver sheen despite the gloom of the pavilion.
Beatrix heard a sharp intake of breath next to her. She glanced sideways. Adrian was gripping the iron railing of the viewing stand. His knuckles were white. He was staring at the gray gelding with an expression of such naked, unguarded grief that Beatrix had to look away.
"He's a good horse," Adrian said. His voice was low, rough, meant only for her. It was the first time he had spoken to her unprompted in 3 weeks. "Mr. Finch tells me he is worth £400, Beatrix replied, keeping her voice strictly professional. She pulled her ledger from her pocket and opened it.
"500, easily," Adrian muttered. He didn't look at her. He kept his eyes on the horse. The handler was walking Goliath in a tight circle. "I bred him myself, raised him from a foal. He's the only horse in the stable with the stamina for the heavy mud in the northern shires." The auctioneer started the bidding. "Do I hear 200? £200 to start." Adrian shifted his weight. His broad shoulders hunched inward, as if bracing against a physical blow. He turned his head just slightly to look at Beatrix. "Don't sell him," Adrian said. It wasn't a demand. It lacked the haughty entitlement of the man she had met 3 months ago. It was a plea, entirely stripped of pride. It was the voice of a man asking for a singular drop of water in a desert. Beatrix stared at the ledger. The numbers blurred. The cold air suddenly felt suffocating. She could smell his clove soap, fainter now, mixed with the harsh scent of the stables.
She looked at the horse. It was just a horse. But to Adrian, it was a piece of his identity, a living, breathing thing he had nurtured. She was selling it to pay for the wine he had drank at a club where men laughed at her name.
"The stable upkeep is ruinous," Beatrix said, her voice sounding thin and defensive to her own ears. "We agreed to liquidate all non-essential assets."
"I'll dismiss the remaining footmen at the gatehouse," Adrian said quickly, turning fully toward her. His gray eyes were desperate, pinning her in place. "I'll chop my own wood. I'll reduce my living allowance by another 20%. Just keep the gray. Keep Goliath."
£300, the auctioneer yelled. "300 to the gentleman in the brown bowler."
Beatrix looked at Adrian's hands gripping the rail. She saw the dirt packed under his fingernails. A duke with dirt under his nails. He really was chopping his own wood. He was living on the meager allowance she had dictated, wearing last season's coats, begging her for the life of a horse. This was victory. This was the absolute crushing dominance she had bought with her inheritance. Why did it feel like poison in her stomach?
She looked away from him, staring hard at the auctioneer, her jaw clenched so tightly, her teeth ground together. The logical, wounded part of her brain screamed at her to hold the line.
He ruined you. He didn't care about your feelings. Do not care about his.
350, the auctioneer called.
Going once?
Beatrix, Adrian whispered. It was the first time he had used her given name since the summer. It felt like a hook catching in her ribs.
She closed the ledger with a sharp snap.
400, a new voice shouted from the crowd.
400 pounds. Going twice. Beatrix opened her mouth. She didn't know what she was going to say. She didn't know if she was going to stop the auction or let the hammer fall. Her heart battered against her sternum. She looked at Adrian. He was holding his breath, waiting for her mercy. The mercy he had never shown her.
Sold! The auctioneer roared, slamming the gavel down. For 400 pounds!
Adrian exhaled. It was a long, shaky breath that sounded like a tire deflating. He didn't say anything. He slowly released his grip on the iron railing. He stepped back from the edge of the ring, his posture retreating into that brittle, defensive shell. Beatrix stood frozen. She hadn't spoken. She had let the hammer fall. The handler led Goliath out of the ring. The horse let out a loud, confused whinny as it was pulled toward the buyer's holding pens. Adrian turned up the collar of his coat. He didn't look at her. "If you are finished with the inventory for today, my lady," he said, his voice completely dead, devoid of any emotion, "I will return to the gatehouse. It is a long walk to the station."
He turned and began to walk away, dissolving into the crowd of shouting men and smelling cigar smoke.
Beatrix stood by the railing, alone. She had 400 more pounds in her ledger. She had broken another piece of his spirit. She pressed her cold, trembling hands against her face, smelling the damp wool of her gloves, and realized with a sickening, terrifying clarity that breaking him was going to break her, too.
Kent in December was not picturesque. It was a bleak, freezing expanse of gray sky and sodden brown earth. Ashbourne Manor sat in the center of it like a decaying tooth.
Beatrix had occupied the main house for 3 weeks. She lived in only 3 rooms to save on coal. The rest of the sprawling, 50-room Elizabethan monstrosity was draped in dust sheets, freezing and silent. The air inside smelled of beeswax, stale soot, and the creeping dampness of rotting window frames. She sat in the library, a massive cavern of leather-bound books and drafty windows. She wore 2 wool cardigans over her dark dress. Her fingers were stiff with cold as she traced the columns of the estate ledgers. The door handle rattled. Adrian walked in. He didn't knock. He hadn't knocked since the day she took his ring. He carried an armful of split logs. He wore a rough canvas coat over a frayed wool sweater. His boots were caked in thick yellow mud. He looked like a poacher who had wandered into the wrong house. He walked to the hearth, knelt, and began building a fire. He didn't look at her.
"The wood is wet," Adrian said, his voice grating against the quiet room. "The roof on the south woodshed collapsed yesterday under the sleet. I told your Mr. Finch it needed shoring up a month ago. He said there were no funds authorized for outbuildings."
Beatrix kept her eyes on the ledger. "Because the funds are going toward the interest on the Cheapside syndicates you ignored for a year."
"The wood is still wet," Adrian replied flatly. He struck a match. It hissed, caught the damp kindling, and sputtered out. He swore softly, a harsh, ugly sound, and struck another.
Beatrix watched his hands. The knuckles were raw, scraped, and chapped from the cold. There was a smear of soot on his jaw. This was the man who used to spend 3 hours getting dressed for a morning ride in Hyde Park. She hated the sudden, sharp pang of pity in her chest. She clamped down on it. Pity was a useless emotion. It didn't balance books. "I need you to explain the tenant arrears on the Lower Valley Farms," Beatrix said, her tone deliberately clipped. She turned the ledger around and pushed it to the edge of the mahogany table. 6 families have paid no rent since the spring. Mr. Finch recommends eviction." Adrian stopped trying to light the fire. He stayed kneeling for a moment, staring at the smoking, useless twigs. Then he stood up and walked over to the table. He didn't sit. He leaned over the book, smelling intensely of rain, wet wool, and wood smoke. It was a sharp, earthy scent that completely overpowered the dry dust of the library.
You can't evict them, he said.
He tapped a dirty finger against a name, Osgood. The river flooded the lower valley in April. It drowned the spring wheat. They have nothing to sell, which means they have nothing to pay. That's a risk of farming. It is not an excuse for theft.
Adrian looked at her. His gray eyes were bloodshot, ringed with deep purple exhaustion. Osgood has 5 children, Beatrix. The youngest has a cough that rattles his ribs. If you throw them out into the sleet, they will die on the road to London. Is that what you want? Shall I have Mr. Finch add a column for body counts in his ledger?
The cruelty in his voice was precise. It hit exactly where he aimed.
Do not presume to lecture me on morality, Beatrix snapped, her voice rising, echoing sharply off the high ceiling. My grandfather's mills killed men every week. I know exactly where wealth comes from. I know the cost. The difference is, I am not pretending to be a benevolent lord while bankrupting the estate at a baccarat table.
Adrian flinched. The muscle in his jaw jumped. He leaned closer, his hands flat on the desk. I know what I did, he said, his voice dropping to a harsh whisper. I know exactly what I am, but these people are not my gambling debts. They are my responsibility. I failed them. I know that. But you hold the purse strings now. You are the master of Ashbourne. So you get to decide. Do we freeze them out, or do you authorize a draw from the contingency fund to buy seed for the spring? They were inches apart. Beatrix could see the pulse beating frantically at the base of his throat. She could feel the heat radiating off his body, a stark contrast to the freezing room.
She stared into his eyes, looking for the arrogant aristocrat who had abandoned her in the royal gallery. He wasn't there. The man looking back at her was drowning, stripped of his armor, fighting violently for the survival of a family he had previously ignored.
The contradiction made her headache. She wanted him to be a monster. It was so much easier when he was a monster. She looked down at the ledger. She picked up her pen. Her hand was trembling slightly. She dipped the nib in the ink, drew a heavy black line through Mr. Finch's eviction recommendation, and wrote, "Abate rent." Authorized seed draw. She didn't look up. Tell Osgood he has until next harvest. If the crop fails again, he leaves.
Adrian let out a slow, ragged breath. He didn't say thank you. He just pushed off the table, turned, and walked back to the freezing hearth. The storm hit 3 days later. It wasn't a gentlemanly snow. It was a brutal, screaming gale that blew straight off the channel, driving sheets of freezing rain sideways across the Kentish hills.
Beatrix woke at 2 a.m. to the sound of breaking glass. A tree branch had smashed through a window in the east corridor. The house was freezing, the air howling through the halls like a physical entity. She pulled on a heavy wool dressing gown over her nightdress, shoved her bare feet into stiff leather boots, and grabbed a kerosene lantern. She found Adrian in the grand foyer. He was already fully dressed in his canvas coat, holding a coil of heavy hemp rope. A lantern sat at his feet. Standing next to him, dripping wet and shivering violently, was a young boy. It was one of the Osgood children.
"What is happening?" Beatrix demanded, shouting over the roar of the wind rattling the heavy oak doors.
Adrian looked up. His hair was plastered to his forehead. "The river breached the banks. The lower pastures are flooding. The sheep are trapped against the old stone wall."
"Sheep?"
Beatrix stared at him. "It is the middle of the night. It's freezing. You cannot go out there."
"If we lose the flock, the estate loses a quarter of its annual income," Adrian yelled back. He looped the rope over his shoulder. He grabbed the boy by the shoulder, guiding him toward the door. "Tell your father I'm coming. Go straight to the ridge."
The boy slipped out into the howling dark.
Adrian reached for the heavy iron latch of the door.
"Wait," Beatrix said. The word tore out of her throat. He paused, looking back at her, his face half shadowed by the flickering lantern light. "I don't need your permission to save your assets, Lady Beatrix."
"I'm coming with you." Adrian stared at her as if she had lost her mind. "You are wearing a nightgown."
"I own the flock,"
she said fiercely, ignoring the absurdity of her outfit. "I own the land. I will not sit in a drafty house while you freeze to death trying to protect my collateral." She didn't wait for him to argue. She turned, ran to the cloakroom, and dragged a heavy oilskin gamekeeper's coat over her dressing gown. It smelled violently of old dogs and wet leather. 5 minutes later, they were fighting their way down the hillside. The cold was an assault. It punched through the oilskin, biting into Beatrix's bare legs above her boots. The rain was like crushed ice, blinding her. She followed the dim, swinging arc of Adrian's lantern. The ground underfoot was a treacherous slide of freezing mud and slick, dead grass. She slipped twice, skinning her knees on unseen rocks, but she didn't stop. She couldn't hear Adrian, couldn't hear anything over the screaming wind. They reached the lower pasture. It was a nightmare of rising black water. The river had crested, spilling a violent torrent across the flat land. Against the far stone wall, a miserable, bleeding mass of gray wool was huddled together. The water was already up to their knees. Adrian waded in. The water hit his thighs. He didn't hesitate. He grabbed the nearest sheep by the thick wool of its neck, wrestling the panicked, heavy animal toward the slope. Beatrix waded in after him. The shock of the freezing water stole her breath. It was a physical agony, a cold so deep it burned. She waded toward the flock. The animals smelled horrific, a pungent, oily stench of panic and wet fleece. She grabbed a lamb. It thrashed violently, its hooves kicking against her thighs, bruising her beneath the wet nightdress. She hauled it up the bank, her boots sinking deep into the mud. For an hour there was no Duke. There was no creditor. There was only the screaming wind, the freezing black water, and the brutal mechanical labor of dragging animals out of the flood. Beatrix's hands went entirely numb. She could no longer feel her feet. She slipped in the mud, falling hard onto her side. The icy water rushed over her face, filling her mouth with the taste of silt and dead leaves. Before she could panic, a hand clamped onto the collar of her oilskin coat. Adrian hauled her up. He was gasping for breath, his face pale and smeared with mud. He didn't let go of her coat. He pulled her against his chest to keep her from slipping back down the bank. For 5 seconds they stood there, chest to chest, the storm raging around them. Beatrix felt the heavy, frantic pounding of his heart against her ribs. She felt the desperate, bruising grip of his hands. "Go back to the house!" Adrian roared, his face inches from hers. "You're going to die out here." "Don't tell me what to do!" Beatrix screamed back, the pent-up rage of the last 4 months finally exploding out of her. It wasn't about the sheep. It wasn't about the water. She shoved him back. He stumbled but caught his balance.
"I bought you," she screamed into the wind, tears of frustration mixing with the freezing rain on her face. "I own you. Stop trying to be noble. You ruin me to save your own miserable pride. Stop making me feel sorry for you."
Adrian stared at her, the wind whipping his wet hair. The lantern at his feet cast harsh, upward shadows on his face. "I didn't ask for your pity," he yelled back, his voice tearing. He took a step toward her, his fists clenched at his sides. "I know I ruined you. I think about it every single day. I am a coward. But you didn't just ruin me, Beatrix. You gutted me. You put a collar around my neck and you parade me around to watch me bleed. So don't you dare complain about the blood."
They stood there, panting, shivering, screaming the ugly, rotten truth at each other in the dark. The hatred was pure. The anger was absolute. And beneath it, a terrible magnetic exhaustion. Beatrix stared at him. Her teeth were chattering so violently she could barely keep her mouth closed. She felt entirely empty. The vendetta had finally burned itself out, leaving nothing but cold ash and freezing mud. She turned away from him. She waded back into the water, grabbed another thrashing sheep by the fleece, and dragged it up the hill. Adrian didn't say another word. He waded in beside her. They worked in absolute silence until the water receded and the flock was safe. The dawn was the color of bruised iron. Beatrix sat in the study. She had bathed in tepid water, scrubbed the freezing mud from under her fingernails, and changed into a dry wool dress. Her muscles ached with a deep, throbbing intensity. Every time she drew a breath, her lungs felt scraped and raw. A fire blazed in the hearth. This time, she had ordered the footman to use the good, dry oak. On the desk in front of her sat two things: the heavy red-bound ledger of Adrian's debts, and the gold carnelian signet ring.
The door opened. Adrian walked in. He was clean, his hair damp from a wash basin. He wore a simple gray suit, stripped of any aristocratic finery. He moved stiffly, favoring his left knee. He looked older. The last 4 months had carved deep, permanent lines into the corners of his mouth and eyes. He stopped a few feet from the desk, his hands clasped behind his back. He didn't look angry anymore. He just looked hollowed out.
"The flock is secured," Adrian said quietly. His voice was hoarse from screaming in the wind. "We lost three. The rest will recover."
"Sit down," Beatrix said.
He hesitated, then pulled out the heavy leather chair opposite her and sat. He kept his eyes carefully fixed on the inkwell.
Beatrix looked at him. She remembered the man in the summer gallery, the careless aristocrat who had dismissed her with a bored wave of his hand. That man was dead. She had killed him. She had suffocated him with his own promissory notes and buried him in the mud of his own estate. But the man sitting across from her now, the man who had hauled her out of the freezing river, was a different creature entirely. He was a survivor, like her.
"I'm leaving for London this afternoon," Beatrix said. The quiet of the room felt fragile.
Adrian looked up. A flash of alarm crossed his gray eyes.
"Why?"
"Because I am tired, Adrian," Beatrix said. She didn't try to hide the exhaustion in her voice. The cold iron facade she had worn for months finally cracked, and she let it fall away. "I am tired of auditing your life. I am tired of smelling damp plaster and freezing in this mausoleum. And most of all, I'm tired of hating you." Adrian swallowed hard. He looked down at his raw, bruised hands.
"So you are selling the estate?"
"No." Beatrix picked up the red ledger. She traced the gold lettering on the spine. "You owe me £194,000. I am not forgiving a single penny of it." She set the ledger down and picked up a piece of crisp, white parchment. She slid it across the desk toward him. "This is a formal mortgage agreement," Beatrix explained, her voice steadying into a calm, business-like cadence. "The wardship is dissolved. I am returning your power of attorney. You will manage the estate. You will manage the tenant farms. You will pay me an interest rate of 4% quarterly, deposited into my account at the Bank of England." Adrian stared at the paper. He didn't touch it. He looked up at her, his expression a complicated mix of shock and profound suspicion. "You are giving me control again, just like that. Why?"
"Because you care about the sheep," Beatrix said simply.
Adrian blinked.
"You are a terrible duke," Beatrix continued, her tone conversational, devoid of malice. "You are a disastrous gambler. You are a coward when it comes to society. But last night you proved you are a passably decent farmer. This land needs a farmer, Adrian, not an auditor."
She picked up the gold signet ring. It caught the light of the fire, the red carnelian glowing like a hot coal. She reached across the desk and held it out to him. "Take it," she said. "Rebuild your house. Pay your debts. But understand this. If you miss a single quarterly payment, if you return to the tables at Cheapside, if I hear even a whisper that you are neglecting the Lower Valley tenants, I will return. And I will not bother with a writ of possession next time. I will simply burn the house down."
Adrian looked at the ring sitting in her pale palm. Slowly, his hand reached out. His bruised, scraped fingers brushed against hers. The touch was electric, startlingly warm after the freezing night. He didn't flinch away. He picked up the ring. He didn't put it on his little finger. He held it in his palm, closing his fist tightly around it. He looked at Beatrix. The defensiveness was gone. The hatred was gone. What remained was a stark, uncompromising respect. It wasn't the soft, flowery romance of a ballroom. It was the hard, unyielding bond of two people who had seen the absolute worst in each other, who had ruined each other, and who had decided to stop digging the grave. 4% is a steep interest rate, Adrian said, his voice raspy, a faint, ragged ghost of a smile pulling at the corner of his mouth. It is the price of doing business, Beatrix replied, her own mouth twitching in a mirror of his expression. She folded her hands on the desk. I'm a woman of transactional affections, after all.
Adrian closed his eyes for a moment, absorbing the hit, accepting the truth of it. When he opened them, the gray was clear and steady. "Yes, you are," he said softly. He slipped the document toward him and reached for the pen. "And I am in your debt." He signed his name. Not as a ruined prisoner, but as a man finally owning the cost of his own life. The ink dried on the paper, black as iron, sealing the bargain between them. Beatrix tore down a duke's pride, but in the ruins they found something stronger than vengeance. A brutal, honest partnership forged in freezing mud and cold ledgers. This isn't a fairy tale. It's the reality of what happens when you buy a man's soul and force him to earn it back. If you love this deep dive into the messy, raw mechanics of revenge and redemption, smash that like button. Subscribe to the channel so you never miss our next dark historical drama. And drop a comment below. Would you have kept the horse? See you next time.